I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night, seven presidential hopefuls took to the stage for the sixth Democratic debate. Vice President Joe Biden, Senators Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Amy Klobuchar, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, entrepreneur Andrew Yang, and billionaire Tom Steyer. There are other candidates who are still running, but they did not meet the higher bar set by the DNC to qualify for this debate. The first half of the evening followed the now well-worn format of questions and timed answers about a range of important issues, things like impeachment and the economy, taxes, climate change, foreign policy, trade. But then things got heated when Senator Warren took on Mayor Buttigieg about a recent fundraiser.
The mayor just recently had a fundraiser that was held in a wine cave full of crystals and served $900 a bottle wine. Think about who comes to that. He had promised that every fundraiser he would do would be open door, but this one was closed door. We made the decision many years ago that rich people in smoke-filled rooms would not pick the next president of the United States. Billionaires in wine caves should not pick the next president of the United States.
Mr. Mayor, your response. You know, according to Forbes magazine, I am literally the only person on this stage who's not a millionaire or a billionaire. So if this is important, this is the problem with issuing purity tests you cannot yourself pass.
Later, Senator Klobuchar took on Mayor Pete Buttigieg, belittling his lack of experience and failure to win a statewide race in Indiana. Well, today in Radio Times, we discuss and dissect last night's debate, assessing the candidate's standing and what promises to be a bruising race for the White House. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Ryan Cooper is national correspondent for the week. And Ryan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
Also with us, Kelly Dittmar. She's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden's campus. Also scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers Eagleton Institute of Politics. And Kelly, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us from Penn State is Candace Watt-Smith. She's an associate professor of political science and African American studies at Penn State University, co-author of a new book called Stay Woke, A People's Guide to Making All Black Lives Matter. And Candace Watt-Smith, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning. And to our listeners, you can join our conversation, especially if you watched last night's debate. Radio Times at WHYY.org. That's the email. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Well, let's start with Mayor Buttigieg. Seemed like he had a big target on his back last night. Let me start with you, Kelly. Did that surprise you?
I don't think it surprised me. We had expected this in the last debate, that he would start to be the target because he had been moving up the polls in Iowa. And so obviously the candidates are trying to take down the front runner in many of these debates. And in some ways, he is a front runner, at least in this first caucus state. And so there was an expectation that there would be some back and forth with him and trying to attack him. What I think was interesting is that it was on this piece of experience and age to some degree. So as a 37-year-old mayor from South Bend, it was time for some of the other candidates to say, sure, you were successful there, but could you win statewide? Could you win nationwide?
Well, and this whole question, I mean, this has really dogged campaigns, Ryan, for as long as I can remember, which is just the amount of money and the role of donors in campaigns. What did you make of that back and forth?
It was an interesting exchange because, you know, for the last over a decade at least, there's been a systematic organizing effort to get Democrats to not take, you know, big corporate money, do these sort of big dollar closed door fundraisers and so on. And what Pete did there was to just say, it's fine. It's fine to take the money. It doesn't corrupt you in any way. It's actually good. We need everybody's help, and just sort of dismissed the entire argument that these sort of corporate donors and very rich people have way too much influence over the political system and the policymaking apparatus in D.C.
including getting ambassadorships and things like that. But he did say, and we did not include this in this clip, he did say back to her, to Senator Warren, that she took money, and this is true, we fact-checked it, she took money out of her Senate campaign, it's millions of dollars, transferred it to her presidential campaign, and he said to her, you know, big-ticket fundraisers you now denounce, did it corrupt you, Senator? Of course not. So that was his retort.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good sort of, you know, tu quoque, I guess you would say, because, you know, Warren is slightly hypocritical in that way. You know, Bernie Sanders is the only one who has not taken any of that money ever and also returned the only billionaire donation that he got. But, you know, it doesn't address the question, because if Warren was wrong to do that now and now has a different standard, then that would be progress, you would think, even if she is sort of, you know, being a little bit squirrely about it. Like, it's still better to do it than not do it now. And so, you know, like, what exactly are you trying to say there, Pete, other than just make a sort of easy hypocrisy gotcha?
Well, Candace, let me get you in on the conversation, and we will move on from this particular clip, but it's gotten such amount of play. What was your takeaway?
Well, I mean, the back and forth, you know, I think highlighted some of the issues that eventually Amy Klobuchar just said, look, this is an issue of campaign finance, and it's also an issue around Citizens United, and let's talk about that. And so I thought that her redirection to talking about the issues that Democrats care about and ought to be thinking through and dealing with was an important move on her part.
I also thought it was interesting, Candace, that it seemed like the moderates, and that would be Buttigieg and Klobuchar, were kind of fighting over the middle. Did you see that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Klobuchar really made an effort to, I don't know how many times I should have made a tick mark of how many times she said, well, we don't have to do extremes and we don't have to do the status quo. And I can find the middle spot, the Goldilocks. I might have heard that from her, I don't know, maybe five or six,
yeah,
six times
so.
At least. Buttigieg, I don't think he did it as obviously. She made it very pointed to say that she was the moderate candidate on the stage.
I think she said, you know, Midwest is flyover country. For me, it is home.
Mm-hmm.
Let me play another clip. And Ryan, you mentioned this, and this was Bernie Sanders then responding to this back and forth about campaign money and fundraisers and $900 bottles of wine.
I am rather proud, maybe, I don't know, the only candidate up here doesn't have any billionaire contributions. But you know what I do have? We have received more contributions from more individuals than any candidate in the history of the United States of America at this point in an election, averaging $18 apiece. Now, there's a real competition going on up here. My good friend Joe, and he is a good friend, he's received contributions from 44 billionaires. Pete, on the other hand, is trailing, Pete. You only got 39 billionaires contributing. So, Pete, we look forward to you. I know you're an energetic guy and a competitive guy, to see if you could take on Joe on that issue.
I love Bernie Sanders' new sense of humor. It's really actually quite delightful. But this is such an important point. And let me toss something to you, Kelly, which is, you know, you can go to fundraisers and raise money, and you can get big donations and small donations, or you can be a billionaire.
Yeah.
And we've got several of them running
right.
for president.
Right. Well, the fact that you have Tom Steyer on the stage, most people don't even know who Tom Steyer is, right? He gets on the stage because he can flood the field with advertisements and get just mm-hmm. enough people to both give small donations and put him up in the polls. So that's certainly important. One thing that we should also be talking about, though, in this is beyond who are their donors, who are their actual voters? So where Bernie struggles, right, is in the diversity of some of his voters, both in terms of race, gender. And so the candidates can also be evaluated on those notions, too. I mean, it matters where their support financially comes from and how much and who. But I think Elizabeth Warren, a couple of times throughout the debate, made a point about her selfie lines, right?
Yes.
Which folks may not take that seriously until you start thinking about the way she's engaging with a wide swath of voters.
How did you see that, Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, on the point of diversity, it's definitely true that, I mean, that really matters given the Democratic coalition, and that's what wiped out Bernie in 2016, was losing the South by like 80 points.
Right.
But it is true also this cycle that Bernie's support base is much more diverse. In fact, I think he has the second most diverse, at least white coalition in the large part, he's doing better among African Americans, but also been cleaning up among Latinos, which has been sort of underreported and probably why he's so strong in Nevada. And, you know, so there was this question about whether the lack of diversity, we'll probably talk about that. But one factor in there is that the candidates of color just haven't been pulling in the numbers from those communities. You know, they're going for Biden and Bernie.
And I do want to pick up on that. Let me just play one very short clip. This is Democratic candidate Andrew Yang answering a question on the fact that he was the only person of color on the stage during last night's debate. Let's give it a listen. And then, Candace, I'll toss it to you.
It's both an honor and disappointment to be the lone candidate of color on the stage tonight. I miss Kamala. I miss Corey, though I think Corey will be back.
So, Candace, as we looked at the stage last night, I mean, obviously there was no Cory Booker. There were Kamala Harris dropped out recently. It is a largely white field of candidates. What happened?
Well, one thing I thought was interesting, and Kelly tweeted about this, is why did they ask Andrew Yang that question? Why did they ask the
such
other,
a good thing? Yes.
But one of the things that I think is important that Yang brought up is that, you know, fewer than 5% of Americans donate, you know, and, you know, thinking about who is in the game to help people, you know, get to this stage. Another thing that stood out is, you know, the DNC chooses, you know, the criteria has to do with both polling and fundraising.
Right.
And there are studies that show that that, you know, the DNC doesn't do their own polls. They have to depend on others. And some of these polls are really white, that they don't incorporate people of color and the proportion that they are in the electorate. And none of them are in other languages. There are no Spanish language. None of the polls are doing their polls in Spanish or any of the, you know, Asian languages. And so, you know, this might influence who's getting, you know, past the criteria on the polling, that we might have seen Castro, that we might have seen Booker if we had more diverse polls or polls that assured that they had representative samples.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. We are talking about last night's debate, what was said, what was learned, where the race is going. Let me just read a quick Facebook comment from Casey, who says the debate was awful. Biden looked better, but Pete looked like a snotty little kid. Liz seemed stiff, and Bernie seemed unable to pivot when asked to. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. More with Kelly Dittmar, Candace Watt-Smith, and Ryan Cooper. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Kelly Dittmar. She's assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University at their Camden campus. She's also a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers Eagleton Institute of Politics. Ryan Cooper also with us here in Philadelphia, national correspondent for the week. And joining us from Penn State University is Candace Watt-Smith. She's associate professor of political science and African-American studies at Penn State University. I want you to say on the air, Ryan, what we were talking about before going on the air, about just how these seven people ended up on the stage, specifically Tom Steyer.
Yeah, so you know, the DNC has certain regulations about, you know, the number of donors you're supposed to have and so on. And one way to get that is the Bernie way, by having a sort of hardcore of fanatics who are ride or die for you no matter what. But another way is to just buy them. You know, you could just spend $100 million on Facebook ads and get, you know, through that spending, people donate money to you. And typically, especially if you're doing it in those sort of like bulk purchasing ways, the number that you get is less than the amount you spent to get the to get the, you know, you're juicing your numbers. Basically, you're inflating your support artificially by spending money to appear as if you have like a loyal donor base. And that, you know, it's talking about money and politics.
There you go.
It's like just straight up corrupting the DNC process by being incredibly rich.
Let me go back to you, Kelly. And just broadly speaking, and even how I think we all felt as it began, it's like, oh, gosh, here we go again. You know, same question, same answers. Yeah. But then I thought there were some really interesting questions that we hadn't heard before.
Yeah.
Some obviously interesting interchanges on the stage as well.
Absolutely.
What did you make of it sort of broadly speaking?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we started out a little slow, if you will. But then there was more engagement between the candidates, which, remember, this is a debate. So at some point you do actually want to see them engage. That's not a negative thing. Mm-hmm. And then I think, you know, there were these moments where we saw what we have thankfully seen over the course of this primary, which is this crowd of candidates having to talk about issues and sort of topics that Democrats even haven't been asked to speak about in presidential debates. And so I thought, to your point earlier about the question about race, it was problematic that they posed the question to Andrew Yang first, but then they did go to Bernie Sanders, and then they asked questions about gender as well. And I think it's telling that for the first time perhaps ever, you have white men being asked about the potential liability of their race and gender in this contest. And some of them struggle to answer, as we saw a little bit Bernie fumble and say, I want to talk about climate change. And then Amna DeVos saying, no, I asked you a question about race and you really need to answer it.
Candace, I mean, this has been, I've said this before, it's been said before in other venues as well, which is the role that the Black voters play in the Democratic Party, and particularly Black women voters play such a pivotal role. I mean, this race question is not going to go away, nor should it. But I was thinking last night that, you know, Black people are used to voting for white people. I mean, I would assume that there's nothing new about that. But it is interesting when you see who was on the dais and who wasn't.
Sure. I mean, I think that Black voters, actually, I mean, you know, sure, having a Black candidate is maybe a plus, but that's really the least of their concerns, right? The main thing that Black folks care about are equity, are resources, is healthcare. When you ask people what issues are important to them, having a Black candidate or a candidate of color, generally speaking, isn't the number one issue, which is why we see quite a number of Black folks, especially young Black folks, supporting Bernie Sanders. Right? They care about healthcare, they care about jobs, they care about education, they care about the environment and climate. And so, you know, I think that it's really important for the candidates to speak to the issues that are of concern to Black voters and to Black women, more so than being a person of color.
Sure. I think what we also saw last night, Ryan, was a more obvious demarcation between the moderate candidates and the ones who are more liberal/progressive.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly had the divergence between Sanders, Warren, and Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and you know, previously it was like Sanders and Warren against everyone, and now it sort of seems as if like that they've sort of brought over a few. Tom Steyer he sounded almost exactly like Bernie on all the important questions, and you know, you see that like the center of gravity has shifted, and even Pete, who has sort of cynically pivoted to the right when, you know, he saw that the Warren and Sanders lanes were already filled up, just he says he's more pragmatic about being moderate. And it's only Klobuchar who is angrily in saying, no, we can't. You can't have the nice things that Bernie won't deliver. and maybe that's why she seems to have such a personal animus towards Buttigieg.
Yeah, it was sort of obvious, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
We should talk about women and anger, though.
Well, no, let's talk about women. Go ahead, Kelly. Go ahead.
I mean, I appreciate Ryan's point, but yeah. I actually think this is really telling, right? So we've heard some of the male candidates and some commentators talk about the anger of both Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar, who are by perhaps the least sort of angry in their delivery. And so there is certainly something about how we evaluate and interpret the behavior of women, which really came up finally in the last question when you had both of them sort of apologize for their hotness, and hotness meaning getting hot, angry, and bluntness from Klobuchar, because they're well aware that this is how voters receive them in ways that are different than their male counterparts.
Well, and there was that question about, you know, what would you prefer to be honest with you, I was asleep by then, but there was a question about, you know, do you want forgiveness
yes.
or do you want to give a present?
Right.
And the two women chose forgiveness.
Forgiveness.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Candace?
I have to say that, well, you know, Elizabeth Warren was the first to say that she wanted forgiveness and feeling so deeply on these issues, which is not a thing to apologize for. Mm-hmm. And then I was really praying that Klobuchar wouldn't do the same thing, and she did.
Yeah.
But then also that none of the men asked for forgiveness. All of the men had something to give, their books, their ideas, their passion. And, you know, more or less, it just grinded my nerve.
Well, Ryan is our lone male here. Go ahead, Ryan.
I gotta be a representative.
You have to represent all men. Yes.
No.
Go ahead.
Yeah, a little Andrew Yang moment here.
Yeah.
I mean, my reaction. I mean, you clearly see, yes, as you're saying, like there's some gender dynamics going on there that are sort of toxic. My instinctive reaction is that's just a really dumb question. Like, what are you talking about? What are we illustrating here, you know, in our few moments that we have to listen to these folks say what they mean? And, you know, on the kind of anger question, I thought that was where Klobuchar was doing the best, you know, and like mm-hmm. backing down from that, you see the sort of like internal programming of culture coming to it. But when she was going after Mayor Pete, I thought, yes, you know, she sounds honest. She sounds like she
means it.
Yeah, and she really means the experience thing, which is something that really hadn't been brought up. That it is in fact incredibly galling to think that you could be mayor of the like 306th largest city in the country and just jump to be the world's most powerful person. So. You know,
and she hammered that in. Kelly, you want to say something?
It's just like the visualization on the debate stage of the double bind. So yeah. I've expressed my passion to you and my anger is righteous because I'm upset about these policy issues. But then let me just make sure you all know, you know, that I understand that you're going to react differently to that, and that I need to justify this anger to you in a way that maybe others don't. I don't think those moments, I was also, you know, I had a similar reaction to Candace, but I had a secondary reaction, which is perhaps, you know, that is authentic. You know, we keep saying we want authenticity. Perhaps there is some authenticity there, and the men could sort of take the model of maybe we should ask some of the men to speak about when they overreact, sort of justify mm-hmm. why they do that.
Well, that would be an interesting question. Let me just reintroduce everybody. We got folks that want to join us. That's Kelly Dittmar, who joins us along with Ryan Cooper here in our Philadelphia studio. Also joining us from Penn State University, Candace Watt-Smith. We are talking about last night's presidential debate. There were 7 Democrats on the stage. There are other Democrats who are also running for president, but for a whole host of reasons that we've been talking about, they did not make it to the stage. Let me play another clip, and this is actually a question that came from Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico. He was one of the moderators last night, asking a question about former President Obama's recent comments on women leaders.
Let's make things interesting. Former President Obama said this week, when asked who should be running countries, that if women were in charge, you'd see a significant improvement on just about everything. He also said, quote, if you look at the world and look at the problems, it's usually old people, usually old men, not getting out of the way.
So, Candace, who was that remark or that comment from President Obama? Who do you think that was aimed at? Candace? I like that pause. It's always good to think first, right?
Well, you know, my husband, he said, I think that's aimed for Michelle Obama to become president in 2024.
That's very interesting. Right, right.
But, you know, one of the things that stood out to me was Bernie Sanders' response was, power isn't black or white or old or young. It's the 1%. And then I thought, but the 1% is mostly old white guys, Bernie. And he, you know, he's got the support of folks of color who are, you know, trying to, they want him to have a better analysis of race, and he just doesn't. And so that was the thing that stuck out to me was how Bernie responded to that question.
Is that because he's an old white guy?
Yeah, I mean he has a lot of policies that would be helpful to people of color and to poor people and to middle class people, but he just can't get his race analysis right, and it is annoying because it's so critical in this moment to think about the ways in which people, you know, black folks, Latinos, especially Latino immigrants, are being excluded, are being attacked in this country. And so there's something that's missing there in Bernie Sanders' analysis. And even his response to that question just seemed He's struggling.
Kelly, go ahead, and then we got some folks that want to join us.
Yeah, I think just to Candace's point about the sort of type of analysis here, that question in and of itself and sort of the statement is a really broad one. And you saw Yang sort of say, like, yeah, when men are together, they're morons. It was a very simplistic sort of analysis of gender. You didn't see the women say, oh, yeah, because we're women, you should elect us. Because women candidates can't do that, and they shouldn't. They should be talking about how gender is among the credentials, and race and the intersection of gender and race is among the credentials they bring because of the experience that comes with that. And somebody like Bernie or Biden could talk about the fact that being white men means they haven't shared these same experiences and they don't have the same perspective. That would be, I think, to Candace's point, getting closer to the type of analysis mm-hmm. that is necessary to say, I get it and I'm willing to learn.
Sure. Here's an email from Bob. You said you like Bernie's sense of humor regarding his comments about billionaires supporting his rivals, but the corrosive effects of money in the democratic process is something all voters should keep in mind when choosing a candidate. I mean, absolutely no question about that. Let me get mm-hmm. Arlene from Mount Laurel to join our conversation. Arlene, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I watched the entire debate last night, and I came away with two really important opinions on this. First of all, I thought the smaller number on the debate stage really was good. It enabled me to get a better feel for each one of their policies and to see the interaction on the stage. And that, I really think that the smaller number is so much more shows so much more of what the candidates are saying and how they feel about issues. And the second thing that I found that was really important was I thought all the questions really covered a broad spectrum of issues, and I really thought they were excellent. And they allowed me to get a second look at some of those candidates that we kind of overlooked before. And for me, that was very enlightening. I mean, I just thought, wow, you know, especially like Amy, this person is shining pretty nicely. So I think it gave a really nice broad overview of the candidates themselves instead of, you know, a whole group where you're trying to figure out what each one is saying.
Well, Arlene, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm going to toss your comments over to Ryan just for your reaction.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. That fewer candidates, you know, you don't have this melee of 10 or 12 people or however many it has been, where you're just like bopping back and forth between people and you have these big shouting matches of people trying to elbow each other out of the way to get some airtime. And then, you know, you can have a little bit more of a substantive conversation. And then I think, you know, the other thing that the questions I thought were not quite so good, but they definitely were substantive. We had a great foreign policy discussion. We had a great climate change discussion, and those were largely overlooked in a lot of the other ones. And I think, you know, you look at who's conducting this debate. You got PBS and you got Politico. Previously, you know, you have like cable news blowhards at CNN, and like those people don't neither know nor care about policy, really. They just want to see some fireworks, you know, like fight. Mm-hmm. And it is mystifying to me why the DNC allows these cable news companies to run. Just let C-SPAN do it. Democrats who want to, you know, they don't want to watch, you know, Chris Cuomo or whoever, or Chuck Todd ask obnoxious process questions. They want to see like a discussion of the issue.
You're saying real journalists.
Yeah.
And also, again, in terms of diversity, the only women of color on stage were two of the debate moderators, who also asked questions, sort of deep questions about immigration. It wasn't a broad immigration question. Somebody like Amna DeVos, who's been doing reporting from the border and could ask that question with a lot of sort of background and really push the folks to answer. And Yamiche Alcindor, who asked a lot of really important questions, including a question about transgender rights, which led to some topics that, again, haven't been talked about in previous elections.
A comment from Amy says, I think it's important to note that Bernie is leading the polls in terms of Latinx supporters. Is that your analysis, Ryan?
Last I've seen, yeah, that is true. And I'm not
this
even
is according
sure
to CNN, according to Amy.
Yeah.
Do you want to jump in on that, Candace? We're almost up in a break here.
Yeah, I actually want to go back to Arlene's point in that I did think that having fewer was better. But we also have to remember that the DNC's criteria doesn't really incorporate, questions, doesn't account for inequality in fundraising in the polls. Fair and enough. How the polls are conducted.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking about last night's presidential debate among seven Democrats. These are the ones who qualified, who meet the criteria set up by the DNC. Talking with Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University at their Camden campus. Ryan Cooper, national correspondent for the week. Candace Watt-Smith, political science professor at Penn State University, author of a book called Stay Woke. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Call us, 1-888-477-9499. Have you picked your candidate yet? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with our guests about last night's debate among seven Democrats running for president. Talking about the state of politics, there's some other issues I want to make sure that we talk about as well. First, though, here's a NewsHour moderator, Amna Nawaz, asking a follow-up question to Vice President Joe Biden about what he knew about the state of the war in Afghanistan when he was vice president, following recent reporting in the Washington Post that has revealed the U.S. officials did mislead the public about the war and how it was going.
The question was about your time in the White House, though.
And I'm talking about the White House.
In that Washington Post report, there's a senior national security official who said that there was constant pressure from the Obama White House to produce figures showing the troop surge was working, and I'm quoting from the report here, despite hard evidence to the contrary. What do you say
Since
to that?
Since 2009, go back and look, I was on the opposite side of that with the Pentagon. The only way I can speak to it now is because it's been published. It's been published thoroughly. I'm the guy from the beginning who argued that it was a big, big mistake to surge forces to Afghanistan, period. We should not have done it. And I argued against it constantly.
And we did fact check, and Vice President Biden is apparently correct about what he said right there. It's interesting, we're 40 minutes in, and we haven't really talked about Joe Biden, who is, and I'll put this to you, Candace, who is the, you know, front runner, depending on, I guess, nationally speaking. I'm not sure he's the front runner when it comes to Iowa or New Hampshire, but nonetheless, you know, he's a known quantity. How do you think he did last night, and what do you make of his candidacy, Candace?
Well, I mean, what I think is interesting about Biden is that he has this balancing act of keeping close to the good parts of the Obama administration and distancing from the parts that people in retrospect see as not good. I mean, I'm not sure anyone wants to be in that position. Last night, I mean, I think he did fine. He, you know, he was a lot more clear than he has typically been, pointed. I think he did fine.
Yeah. For Biden, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not trying to be mean about that. I just think that there, and Ryan, I'll give you a chance to weigh in as well. I think, you know, he's in a special category, I would say.
Yeah, he is. And I mean, from my read, this was his best debate by quite a bit, just because he sounded like a regular candidate and didn't have any, you know, parts where he just like trailed off into random babbling or just incoherent nonsense, which he has done in all the previous debates, I think. And, you know, it is a sort of difficult straddle for him, I imagine. But, you know, some of the really worst parts of the Obama's administration haven't really come up yet. You know, their policy of like deliberately causing millions of foreclosures, that's just hasn't been talked about.
And deliberately?
Yeah, through the HAMP program, where they use the homeowner bailout money, and basically there's a backdoor bailout for the banks. It's a complicated story. I could get into it, but this to happen, you can trust me. This was Tim Geithner at the Treasury, as he told Elizabeth Warren, actually, that the purpose was to foam the runway for the banks, in that famous phrase. But, you know, it's a difficult thing, but it's been easier because there really hasn't been a lot of challenging about how, like, the Obama administration at the end of the day bobbled the most important task of its of the term, which was to fix the Great Recession. They did about halfway. And, you know, we're still living with the consequences today.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think about Joe Biden, you know, not only having to defend or find that middle ground for the for President Obama, but also, Kelly, all his, you know, he was in the Senate so many years,
yeah.
All those previous votes, some of which are haunting him, some I think people maybe have forgiven him for or he has moved on from.
Yeah, I mean, there's votes, there's Anita Hill, I mean, continually, you know, we sort of need to remember this moment in history where you have Anita Hill to this day saying, you know, I haven't received the apology that he sort of says he feels. And then even more recently, some of his behaviors towards women and his conversations and comments about race, these are things he, you know, obviously is confronted a bit, but will have to confront even more as he continues on in this race. What's sort of interesting is that Pete Buttigieg has been sort of taking away some of the fire towards Biden because of our campaign schedule, because of Iowa. And so this, for the Biden campaign, I would argue, is probably a good thing, because even if he comes in a close second in Iowa or something like that, it doesn't hurt him. And he didn't take all the fire in these debates that you would have if you were technically seen as in first place going into those caucuses.
Mm-hmm. Candace, let me ask you about something else. This is not related to last night's debate, but the fact that the state of Georgia just recently expelled 300,000 people from the voter rolls. And this is happening in other states as well. I think it was Senator Sanders last night saying, you know, if you want to beat President Trump, you got to get out and vote. But if there are these purges taking place, and of course, you know, the whole Voting Rights Act is on the table as well. How do we address this as a country?
Well, I mean, I think Klobuchar actually was one of the ones who talked about voting rights, which I think a little bit surprised me. But, you know, the thing is that the Democratic Party, if they want to win this election, they're going to have to get out the vote. They're going to have to turn people out. And so, yeah, there's tons of potential. But historically speaking, people vote because someone asked them to vote and someone showed them what to do and someone helped them. And so if the Democratic Party is going to have to do that, and, you know, and I'm not saying don't complain about the purges, but they're going to have to do something. So, you know, folks like Stacey Abrams is getting out the word, but she's also registering people to vote. And so the candidates, all of the Democratic candidates are going to have to work toward that.
Let me read a couple of more questions or comments. One from Paul. Can Sanders or Warren really get at any of their progressive policies through a Republican Senate? I think they can do most good if they stay in the Senate instead of giving up their seats. A tweet from Michael. 26% of the population have a disability, yet our candidates rarely discuss the topic or the needs of such constituents, although it did come up last night. Mm-hmm. A tweet from Kirsten. I wish the debate had covered Puerto Rico policy between the Jones Act and HUD funds being withheld. There is so much to discuss. All interesting comments. Anything you want to say?
On the speaking of Puerto Rico, actually, on the voting, you know, the Senate, the quickest and easiest way to reverse the massive Republican bias in the Senate would be to make D.C. and Puerto Rico a state. You know, there's some question about whether Puerto Ricans actually want that, and of course they would have to vote for it. But there you go, bang, four senators to make it less of a sort of House of Lords, rotten boroughs type of horribly undemocratic institution that, you know, will strangle any progressive legislation in the cradle. And, you know, that I think, along with, you know, the Voting Rights Act, ought to be day one, first thing you do as the new president, because it will make everything else, even, you know, in the remotest land of possibility. Mm-hmm.
Kelly, you want to add something?
Just on Paul's point about the sort of how realistic are these plans, this obviously came up in the debate. Warren and a little bit Bernie were pushed on how realistic they are. But I think this speaks to a broader question about what kind of candidate and what kind of message the Democrats are going to embrace this time. Is it sort of aspirational? We want to shoot for the stars. We know we might not get it. Is it hope and change, if you will, if you recall a couple years back?
Or nope and change, right? I think, as you said, Ryan.
Or is it pragmatic, which is really, you know, what the Clinton campaign tried for, and it fell short. And obviously, there were a number of other reasons why that campaign fell short, but at least in the Electoral College. But it certainly, this is a debate always in politics, but I think especially this year when confronted with Donald Trump as the opponent.
Well, and interestingly, Candace, I'll toss this to you. I mean, this was another insanely busy week news-wise, and of course, the day before the debate. On Thursday night, the president of the United States was impeached. And so we're at this just sort of wild moment. Not sure exactly what's going to happen in the Senate, but it's hard to sort of catch your breath, I think, when so many things are in play.
I have to say that I actually wasn't going to watch the debates, but I felt like it would be a good turn away from the impeachment. I was actually disappointed that they spent a good amount of time talking about impeachment. They ask every candidate the same question about impeachment, which I would have preferred them ask every candidate a question about transgender rights or about federal judges or college affordability or any of the other questions. So, I mean, the thing is that I think we all know how this impeachment thing is going to go down in the Senate. And so it's kind of non-news in some ways. I hate to kind of diminish it. I mean, it's important, but we know what's going to happen. And so it would have been nice to have used the time to spend on spend on some of the questions that are really of concern to the electorate.
And my memory is that the opening questions were all about impeachment, but then I'm pretty sure that they moved on from there. Every now and then it would come back in an answer, but I think, you know, largely moved on and covered a lot of the issues that that Candace, you were just referencing there. But it is interesting, Ryan, just to, you know, do a sort of a little game imagining who of those people, and we should say there are other people running for president, but who of those people could take on President Trump in a debate? Were you able to come to I wasn't sure.
A debate.
Yeah, and that very much that debate setting.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Hillary Clinton just wiping the floor with Trump in every debate, and it seemed to have no effect at all on the later outcome. But I think that there are maybe two candidates who would be, off the top of my head, the ones that I would like to see a debate. And that number one would be Biden. So you could just see these two sort of elderly weirdos just sort of trailing off and rambling about.
Just for entertainment purposes?
Yes.
Okay, not for who's going to be president of the United States?
And I think also that...
There is an election.
Yeah, there is an election. Reminder there, Brian. But go ahead.
Setting that aside, I think he would probably struggle the most against Bernie, because Bernie is just doesn't... he's not interested in like all of Trump's sort of... politics of, you know, name calling and saying weird things. He just brings everything right back to his talking points that is just aimed directly at Trump's failure to keep his promises of being a genuine economic populist and not a, you know, handmaiden of the billionaire class, which is basically how he is governed. And but I think really any of the candidates could probably beat him. He's a disorganized, like quasi senile guy. He was a very weak debater against Clinton, and he's only gotten older since then.
Well, and raises question about do debates matter? But Kelly, I'd be curious about your little.
I mean, I think the best. I mean, the one who I both entered for entertainment purposes, but I also think in terms of who would have done really well against him would have been Kamala Harris. And so I do you know, sort of am sad that we aren't going to see that. For a number of reasons, but one of which, Donald Trump does not do well when women or women of color question his power or his masculinity. And I think there is actually, oddly, perhaps an advantage that we might see if it is a woman or a candidate of color standing across from Donald Trump on the debate stage, both for contrast in a sort of visual way, but also because he can't quite handle it.
What do you think, Candace?
Same. I mean... One of the things I thought about Klobuchar and how she threw so much shade on the mayor, you know, to see her with Trump or Warren. I mean, she has plans and facts and numbers. And, you know, again, maybe debates don't matter, but I think it would be nice to see a woman debate Trump.
Here's an email from Jeffrey, who says, I think the debate process is cheapened when held in front of a live audience. The candidates appear to play to the audience rather than really engaging with each other. You mentioned Iowa, and the mm-hmm. caucuses are, I believe, in early February.
Yeah.
These are caucuses. These are not primaries.
Yes.
And this is Iowa.
Yes.
I mean, it seems to me, Kelly, is there just too much attention paid to this caucus or these caucuses?
So putting on a sort of scholar hat, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that this is problematic, that this one state has so much influence on what happens going forward in the race. I think other states have obviously moved up their primaries so that they can have more of an impact. So you have areas like states like South Carolina, you have some California, others moving up, and so that matters. From a political standpoint, though, that's the reality. And so certainly that means that these candidates are both going to cater to those voters, and those who are doing sort of commentating and guessing are saying, well, depending on what happens in Iowa, we'll know then who's sort of in the lead. So it's sort of a double-edged situation.
And then comes New Hampshire, which is also
very representative.
Not the Deep South, right?
Yeah. The whole country looks exactly like New Hampshire. No, I mean, the entire system is just completely nonsensical. You know, you look at the UK, they had an entire general election in 2 months. You know, we can barely do it in 2 years. And the primary calendar schedule is ridiculous. And the time it takes is also ridiculous. You know, you ought to have just like 4 or 5 blocks of states. And they all go, maybe say, you could say 2 month primary, and then they could switch off, you know, this one going first, that one going first. But, you know, yeah, as you say, we're stuck with it now. So Iowa, whatever corn subsidies they want, they get.
Candace,
but everybody should vote.
Candace, can you fix our electoral system in 10 seconds or less?
I cannot.
You cannot. Honest answer. I appreciate all of you joining us today on Radio Times. Candace Watt-Smith, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she's Associate Professor of Political Science and African American Studies at Penn State University, co-author of Stay Woke, A People's Guide to Making All Black Lives Matter. Ryan Cooper, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's national correspondent for The Week. And Kelly Dittmar, thank you for coming in as well.
Good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University at their Camden campus and a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers Eagleton Institute of Politics. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks so much for joining us.